Greetings once again, America. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it's the Weekly World View, coming to you from beautiful downtown Denver, Colorado. Glad to have you aboard for a special midweek edition of the World View. It's the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought. And it's great to be back in a midweek edition here. I want to start with Michelle Obama. That's right, I'm going to start with Michelle Obama. Don't get me started with Michelle Obama. Now, I've got an article here from AdAge.com, and they talk about the fact that Michelle Obama has been gracing a number of covers of a number of fashion and general interest magazines. And she has been obviously embraced by the entire left-leaning liberal world as the new Jackie Kennedy, the great fashion plate of all time, or for our time anyways. Her husband will bring us peace in our time, and she will bring us fashion in our time. Well, according to Ad Age magazine, they say, no doubt Michelle Obama has been embraced by the media world, appearing on cover after cover from Us Weekly to Newsweek. But when it comes to sales, Ms. Obama may not yet the General Interest Magazine's new Princess Diana, who regularly helped the industry sell more copies at newsstands. So Ad Age, which monitors advertising trends, revenue, and whatnot, sort of an industry guide, if you will, in the print advertising world, they say that a Michelle Obama cover on your magazine, it doesn't hurt a General Interest Magazine, the numbers suggest, but it doesn't produce more than an occasional lift either. And let me just be the first person to step out there and say it. It's because Michelle Obama is a fashion train wreck, okay? Everything from that dress that looked like, you remember on, I can't remember if it was the inauguration or if it was the worship event that they held in the park out in Chicago at election time. But she had a dress on that looked like, it looked like blood had exploded on her midriff. And then more recently, over at the Gay 20 meeting, she had a dress that, it looked like the children at the school where she was giving her lecture, it looks like they stitched it together for her out of portions of old draperies and upholstery or something like that. But the media, the news media here in the United States and abroad, simply will not admit the fact that Michelle Obama is fashion impaired. Let's just say that. She's fashion impaired. And, that's all I'm going to say. She wears outfits that make her hips look like a U-Haul trailer. And she doesn't have to do that, okay? But I think she chooses to do it because, not unlike her husband, she's just not all that she's being cracked up to be, okay? And this is just another little insight into the limitations of the Obama appeal. And as I've said in the past, I certainly look forward to the day when Barry Ho and his wife leave the Oval Office with their heads hung down in shame, not unlike the Carters when they departed back in January of 1981. All right. So just mark your calendars that this was the day that the news first surfaced that Michelle Obama is a fashion catastrophe, okay? All right. Now, let's get on to the events that are occurring as we speak during this most exciting. This is Resurrection Week, and we all look forward to celebrating once again en masse, even the general public, giving at least lip service to the resurrection, the crucifixion, the burial, and the physical resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. We look forward to that, and glad to be in the midst of what is turning out to be quite a beautiful, as far as the weather and the conditions, especially here in Colorado, and an eventful Resurrection Week. Now, I want to get to this story about this little Cessna airplane that came out of Canada and flew on down into Missouri, apparently, earlier in the week. I want to read from a story from the wire service. You know, NORAD, who is charged with defending North American airspace, according to the AP wire, NORAD reports that they never seriously considered shooting down a rogue pilot who flew into U.S. airspace because NORAD quickly determined that he had no hostile intent. How did they do this, you might ask? How did they determine this? Well, according to the article, authorities said that the pilot didn't communicate with anyone and had no map or flight plan. So if he didn't communicate with anyone, my question is, how did NORAD determine that he had no hostile intent? According to the article, defense officials quickly learned that the pilot was a man whose born name was Yavuz Berk, a Turk, born in Turkey. So a Turkish gentleman, before he moved to Canada and became a naturalized citizen there in Canada. So here we've got a Turkish man flying a plane, not communicating with anyone, and it was determined immediately that he had no hostile intent. And I'm just not sure how they did that. Maybe I'm not in the defense infrastructure loop here, and maybe I just don't get it. Maybe we have a psychic working there at NORAD who was able to determine through vibrations and the alignment of certain planets and stars that this small plane piloted by a young, formerly Turkish citizen posed no threat to anyone. I know they report in the article that he flew primarily over open space, and he didn't seem to be threatening any infrastructure. And in my opinion, if he's flying over open space and he's not communicating with anyone, that's the perfect time to shoot him down. Well, where he'll land in a farmer's field or something. And it would have sent a message to anyone thinking about trying to nefariously enter U.S. airspace in small aircraft with some hostile intent. It would have sent a message to them that we will not tolerate any breach of our airspace, and it perhaps could prevent some sort of attack in the future. I just get the feeling this was some kind of probing attack or some kind of a probing operation to find out exactly how slack are we in defending our airspace. Now, young Yavuz was arrested on the ground by the FBI, and reportedly, he told the FBI that he, quote, has not felt like himself lately, and that he has been being treated by a psychiatrist. At which point, he was arrested, and he's been taken into custody, and pretty much disappeared off the face of the planet. And I don't know, maybe I'm paranoid, but I think that there are enemies of our country who could organize some sort of attack using a number of small planes, and that what we need to do is show them that there is a wall of defense that they will not penetrate, even at the risk of shooting down an innocent young nut job who's just out on a suicide mission. I think it would have been worth it just to show the world that we will defend ourselves. But there we are. And that'll sort of be a theme of the show this week, it appears, is that our leadership appears to have lost their nerve or lost their common sense, or perhaps they're distracted in trying to codify homosexual marriage and reduce greenhouse gases, and they forget that there are people who want to destroy Western civilization, or at least want to inflict harm and hurt on the people of the West and America in particular. But there are other things on their mind, I suppose. All right. Now, I want to do an update on a story. Now, this is a story that I first covered during the early, early days of the Weekly Worldview back in 1998 when I first started this broadcast over at KGOV.com. It's a story about a gentleman who shot and killed an abortionist. And let me just read to you from the AP article. The Second U.S. Court of Appeals in Manhattan found no merit to challenges raised by James Kopp, that's the gentleman who shot the abortionist. His argument was basically he was convicted in a sniper-style slaying back in 1998 of Dr. Barnett Schlepian, who was shot through the kitchen window of his suburban Buffalo home, if you will recall. Now, he was sentenced, James Kopp was, well, Mr. Schlepian was sentenced shortly after his death to eternity in hell. But Mr. Kopp was sentenced back in June of 07 to life in prison plus 10 years, whatever that means. He was convicted of violating the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act because he killed an abortion provider, which is an interesting finding in and of itself. Now, he was convicted in the state of New York of murder, which is encouraging to know that the state of New York still recognizes certain murders as punishable by law. He was sentenced there to 25 years to life. Now, this most recent filing by James Kopp, he was trying to get his conviction overturned by stating that he didn't mean to kill Schlepian. He only meant to wound him. And he says he has evidence of that because he was suspected, or I should say there is evidence of that because he was suspected in the non-fatal shootings of four other doctors, three in Canada and one in Rochester, New York, between 1994 and 1997. Those abortionists were shot and wounded, but Dr. Barnett Schlepian was shot and killed by one James Kopp. And the government found that this argument, it didn't matter that he didn't mean to kill him. It only mattered that he killed him. The law, according to the judge, does not require that Kopp intended to kill the doctor, according to the AP, only that Kopp acted with malice and demonstrated a heightened disregard for human life when he shot him. And Mr. Schlepian says, quote, I'm sorry, Mr. Schlepian. Mr. Schlepian doesn't have anything to say anymore. Mr. Kopp said, quote, the truth is not that I regret shooting Dr. Schlepian. I regret that he died. I aimed at his shoulder. The bullet took a crazy ricochet, and that's what killed him. Now, what's interesting about this story is I actually agree that Mr. Kopp's assertion that he didn't intend to kill the abortionist has no bearing on the results of his case. He should be found guilty of murder, and of course, he should be executed. But the liberal justice system, in their wisdom and benevolence, have sentenced him to life in prison plus 10 years. I agree that that should have no bearing on his case, but what bothers me is that when I first reported this story, I credited Mr. Kopp with his marksmanship because it was really an impressive shot in the dark, through the kitchen window, took the guy out. I thought this guy is really a good shot, and now I find out that his aim was actually off, and that's just depressing. All right. Now, a funny story out of Provo, Utah, and there's really no point to this story except that it's funny, and that's why I'm going to do it. Dateline Provo, Utah, one edition of the Brigham Young University student newspaper has been pulled from the newsstands because a typo in a caption that referred to Mormon leaders as apostates instead of apostles. That's right, a photo in Monday's Daily Universe out there in Utah showed members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, a governing body of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which owns the university. The caption under the picture called the group the Quorum of the 12 Apostates. Now, university spokeswoman Carrie Jenkins says that it was an honest mistake that happened when an editor was doing a computerized spell check. And so it's kind of funny that the typo got through. And not only does it really reflect the truth of what the Quorum of the 12 there at the Mormon Church is, But more importantly, it points out the fact that these days, even university students can't spell. It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm Doug McBurney. Glad to have you back this week. Special midweek edition of the Weekly Worldview. And just an exciting time we're having here. Having a little fun with the Mormons there. It's great when you get to poke fun at pagan religions and the public university, public and private university system, in what was once Western civilization. And what is now, I have deemed, post-Christendom. Yeah, that's what we're living in, is post-Christendom. And it's just sad, especially here during Resurrection Week, to consider the fact that we have shed the moorings that held us securely to the grace of our Lord and are now drifting aimlessly into a cesspool of mediocrity and eventual destruction at the hands of ourselves, essentially. And it's just sad. Now, I'm going to And on that note, we'll dive into the domestic tranquility file. Now, it's a short file this week because, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, it's getting a bit depressing to follow the news of the death, the destruction, the slaughter, and the mayhem that's being carried out in the streets and the homes and the restaurants and the bars and the nightclubs and, just everywhere here in America. It seems like you just can't get away from it. Especially if you read the news or watch the news for any amount of time, it becomes very obvious that something is happening. There's some sort of meltdown that's occurring in our culture that's being reported by the press almost as if it's entertainment. Almost. Now, it's not outright entertainment yet. There's not yet a murder reality show, although I could see that happening within my lifetime. I could see a murder reality show happening because, after all, there's an awful lot of murder going on out there. It's very dramatic. And I'm sure the productions would be relatively inexpensive for the major networks. I'm sure it's under consideration by someone there in network television. But into the domestic tranquility file, I pulled up an article that describes this past month from about March 10th until April 4th, until just the end of last week. And the headline to the article reads, "In the last month, mass shootings claim 53 lives." And they run through these shootings going back to early March, mid-March, through this past week. And it's horrifying to read that 53 lives have been claimed. But as I was reading this article, I scanned the wires, and I found just today's sampling from the domestic tranquility file. Dateline Castleberry, Florida. A Central Florida woman fatally shot her son and then killed herself at a shooting range. Shot her son in the back of the head. Turned the gun on herself, killed herself. Now, I don't know if this qualifies anymore as a mass shooting, because it almost seems like that unless the killer breaks some kind of record, you've got to break the record. I think the current record is held by Virginia Tech, and it's somewhere north of 20 persons murdered. It seems like the stories like this out of Central Florida that at one time I think would have shocked the nation, a woman shooting her son and then killing herself at a shooting range, is a pretty shocking story and worthy of coverage, but it's just a mere blip on the screen anymore. Also, what else did I find? Dateline Tracy, California. While I was reading about the spate of mass murders here in the past month, came across this story, Dateline Tracy, California. The body of a missing 8-year-old girl has been found in a suitcase dumped in an irrigation pond a few miles from her Northern California home. No suspects have been identified. Just terrible, terrible news. The domestic tranquility has been shaken at its foundations, I think you will agree. And this article, or another article that I had read in association with this, posited the idea that perhaps the faltering economy was somehow an influence on the persons involved in these mass murders. And I really find that hard to believe that it could be the economy, because we've been through economic hard times before. I would challenge one to scan the wire services and newspapers from the Great Depression era and try to find the mass murders. I'm not saying there wouldn't have been one or two mass murders, although maybe there weren't. But I'm just saying that I think we need to look at the moral collapse, not the economic collapse. We have to look directly at the education infrastructure and not the financial infrastructure that has raised a generation of people now who place no value not only on their own lives, because after all, they've just evolved from the slime, they place no value on the lives of other people because they're just as slimy. And we're all just animals here on this big rock hurtling aimlessly at random through the universe. And that's what our education and our culture and unfortunately our churches have raised a generation of people to believe. And this is where it has led us, to the point where mothers are killing their sons, mothers are killing their children, fathers are slaughtering their families and killing themselves to escape some fate that they feel that they can't otherwise escape. And the spiritual perspective, the eternal perspective, has disappeared from the landscape of the culture. It's disappeared from the language. And the fruits of that is violence and death, murder and destruction. And that's what's happening inside America. I can't remember who said it. It may have been Abraham Lincoln, or it may have been another one of our previous political leaders who said that all the armies in the world could mass on the eastern seaboard of the United States with the full force of their attack, and they would never take a drink out of the Mississippi River because they would be defeated by the Americans. If the nation ever were to succumb to destruction, it would certainly be from within. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but a rather prophetic statement, you must agree. And now, let's go now to the International Follies file. We'll go now outside the belly of the beast to the threats external and the events external. The International Follies file right here on the Weekly Worldview. And we'll start with Barry Ho in Ankara, Turkey. If you can imagine that, just picture that. You don't have to picture it. I'm sure you've watched it this week on the news. Barry Ho made his first visit to a Muslim nation this week as the president of these United States. And he declared that the United States, quote, is not and never will be at war with Islam. That's what he said. Not only are we not, we never will be at war with Islam. And Barry Ho, he knows. He's too busy with his war against Christianity and his war against God to bother with a war against Islam, for crying out loud. He's got bigger fish to fry. So Obama said, he said, in fact, our partnership with the Muslim world is critical. It's critical, he says. Our partnership with the Muslim world is critical. Now, I'm no historical, I don't have a PhD in history. I've only studied it in an ancillary fashion as I've moved through my life. But I can't recall exactly when it was that our partnership with the Muslim world, number one, occurred. I don't remember when that partnership occurred. Number two, I don't remember it being critical. In fact, in most of the major conflicts in my lifetime, in my father's lifetime, the Muslim world has been our sworn enemy, aligned with the likes of the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. But maybe Mr. Barry Ho, maybe he has a different perspective on history. Perhaps that's it. It's something that I just don't understand, because I have my beliefs about history and he has his beliefs about history. And after all, are either one of us qualified to say what is right, what is wrong, what is true, what actually occurred? Isn't history really in the eye of the beholder of the most powerful office in the land? Perhaps that is the state that we're in. Mr. Obama says, quote, "We will convey our deep appreciation for the Islamic faith, which has done so much over so many centuries to shape the world for the better, including my own country." At which point I thought again to myself, well, when did that happen? When did the Islamic faith do anything to shape this country? Was there something that they did? Didn't they come up with the number zero? I'll give them that. They came up with the number zero. But how much that really influenced the culture and the creation and the system and the philosophy of free citizens of America, I just don't know that I make that connection, Barry. Maybe you could send some of your friends over to explain to me how it is that the Islamic faith has shaped this country. I mean, I just don't get it. And of course, he got a big round of applause there. And he says he supports the state of Turkey becoming a member of the European Union. And that's interesting, because the European Union does not support the idea of Turkey becoming a member because, well, they claim that they're not European. And it's mostly because of all that Islam. Primarily, that's what they have a problem with over there in Europe. They're just probably that Turkey's just not homosexual enough to be a part of the European Union. They're just not quite tolerant enough. Anyway, I don't know that Turkey wants to entwine themselves with the EU any more than the EU wants to be entwined with Muslim Turkey, okay? Not to put too fine a point on it. Now, an article from The Hill magazine, still deep inside the International Follies file, U.S. envoys this week met with Pakistani leaders to ensure that the money that Barry Ho plans to send their way over the next 5 years will be used to achieve common goals in the fight against extremism. Now, I find that an interesting term, the fight against extremism. That's a rather amorphous term that as situations change, I think that the term extremism could be applied to just about anyone. And isn't that the way politicians speak these days, especially in the international realm? They never want to point to anything specific. They want to keep things a little bit fuzzy so that no one can quite keep track of their failures when they come to light. Like what's about to happen right here in this article. According to a Pakistani newspaper, Regional Envoy Richard Holbrooke and Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen came up empty-handed in their talks with Pakistani leaders and received a rude shock when a proposal for joint operations against Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces in the volatile tribal regions was rejected. That's right, the Pakistani government said, "Thanks, Barry, but no thanks." One newspaper reported that Pakistan also asked the U.S. to turn over the unmanned drone missions over the territory to them, saying that the drone strikes were fueling extremism. Okay, so there's that word again, extremism. We should obviously be scared and concerned about extremism. What a riot this is. Barry Ho, I remember in his campaign, he said that he was going to work with Pakistan, and he was going to even invade Pakistan if necessary in order to defeat Al-Qaeda. And now Pakistan has basically said, "Look, Barry, just get out of here with that. We're not going to take you seriously. There's nothing you can do to us. We are sovereign over our territory, and all your big talk, we realize exactly what that is now, big talk." In fact, you remember when that drone came over into our airspace a few weeks ago and blew up those terrorists? We want to put a stop to that. In fact, we want you to turn those operations over to us because we can handle it, Barry. So Barry's getting played by the Pakistanis over there. And he's getting played for basically for the empty suit that he is. He's a lot of talk. He's got a flashy smile. He comes off as very confident and cool and collected. But when you dig down deep and you scratch off the surface, there's just nothing there. And the Pakistanis recognize that. And by the way, the Pakistanis have a nuclear bomb. Yes, they do. So let's see. Was there anything more in this article? Let's see. Oh, Barry Ho has a plan to battle extremism. There it is again. Extremism in Afghanistan. And it includes sinking $7 billion into neighboring Pakistan, which brokered a deal, by the way, with the Taliban recently in the Northwest Frontier Province that allows the Taliban to impose their brutal interpretation of Islamic law on the populace. So here we are. We've got a government in Pakistan that Barry Ho insists we must work with. They're making deals with the Taliban so that the Taliban can rule some of the tribal regions. And they're basically telling Barry to take his toys and go home. It's the Weekly Worldview with Doug McBurney. I'm so glad to have you with us in this special midweek edition. And we move on through the International Follies File. Dateline New York. I know this is here inside the belly of the beast, but hear me out here. A Chinese businessman accused of helping Iran's military buy materials to make nuclear weapons has been indicted on charges of illegally sending millions of dollars through New York City's bank. New York City banks. The 118-count indictment charges Li Fanghui and his China-based company, LIMMT, Limt. Okay, it's Chinese. What are you going to say? His company, Limt, was identified years ago as a front for Iran's illegal nuclear acquisitions efforts, and they've been accused of falsifying business records and conspiracy to gain access to U.S. banks. And so here we have yet another discovery of our good friends and holders of our national debt, the Chinese, basically helping the Iranians acquire nuclear weapons. But let's not get nitpicky with the Chinese, okay? They do a lot of good. They do a lot of good. They buy a lot of our debt. They prop up the nuclear-armed nut job in North Korea. They slaughter children on a scale that is mind-boggling. They enslave 90% of their population. And we know that they're good people. And that's according to a State Department communique. We know that China and the Chinese, we know that the Chinese government is filled with good people. Now, I'm just making that up, that the State Department sent out a communique, but I think that words to that effect come out of the State Department each and every morning. When you sit down at the State Department with your first cup of coffee and you get the talking points for the day, it starts out with, the government of China is filled with good people doing good things. All right. So another evidence yet that we need drug tests for the folks at the State Department and, well, frankly, throughout government, throughout local, state, and federal government, we need to start drug testing these people. All right. And here's some more evidence of that. Dateline Miami, Florida, in an effort to improve the relationship between Cuba and the United States, Representatives Barbara Lee, Bobby Rush, and Emmanuel Cleaver met with Fidel Castro this week. That's right. And Ms. Barbara Lee, who is a Democrat from Oakland, California, she said, I'm convinced that Raul Castro, that's Fidel's brother, you'll recall. She says, I'm convinced Raul Castro wants a normal relationship with the United States. she said after the meeting. Well, no kidding he wants a normal relationship with the United States, you moron. That's the reason we've cut him off for the last 40 or 50 years. Is because it would be to their financial benefit to have a normal relationship with the United States. Of course they want it. Are you an idiot? Are you on drugs? I want you to pee in this bottle right now, lady. You're driving me crazy. She thinks he wants a normal relationship. Unbelievable. Now, Bobby Rush, he was also there. I can't believe that he's a congressman. Bobby Rush is a congressman. Can you believe this? What has happened to this country? Bobby says, I think that what really surprised me about Fidel, but also endeared me to him, was his keen sense of humor, his sense of history, and his basic human qualities. Now, what is a basic human quality? What, that he wiped his nose? What? That he went to the bathroom? What's a basic human quality? Because this guy is by no means interested in the betterment of his fellow citizens. He's a murderer. He's a communist. But he does have basic human qualities. Puts his pants on one leg at a time, so to speak. Well, Bobby Rush was very impressed with Fidel. And he said, I intend to do everything I can when we get back to the States to make sure that normalization with our relationship with Cuba is given proper consideration, both within the House of Representatives and the neighborhoods of America. That's right, I'm taking it to the streets for Fidel. Thanks a lot, Bobby. So a bunch of geniuses there packing off to Cuba, meeting with a dictator who just won't die. I mean, I was on the edge of my seat, I think it was a year and a half ago. I thought Fidel was on his way out. I thought he was going to finally pass from the scene. But he just won't die. And with a fan club like this, I'm sure he doesn't want to die. He's basically got Democrats bowing down before him. I wonder if Bobby Rush, I wonder if he gave Fidel an iPod. That seems to be the thing to do these days. Give someone an iPod or a stack of CDs. And then, I don't know, get down and worship at his feet. It's just bizarre. And now here's a story that one might think has no relationship to the International Follies file. But bear with me for just a moment. Dateline Berlin from the Reuters Wire. A German woman was involved in 3 car accidents in less than an hour that left a total of 7 vehicles damaged, but she suffered only slight injuries from the series of mishaps. The 69-year-old woman from Berlin first crashed into 3 cars while trying to pull out of a supermarket parking lot. Then she accidentally stepped on the accelerator and sped across a lawn before crashing into a nearby house. She was taken to the hospital in an ambulance, but that vehicle was then hit by a truck. And to me, ladies and gentlemen, this is American foreign policy right here. And it's just a matter of time before that truck comes up on us. It's just scary. All right. Now, let's move on to the Death of Western Civilization file, which is, it's fairly thick this week. And it's going to be a little depressing, folks, but we'll try to have fun with portions of it, okay? From the Death of Western Civilization file, Vermont, this week, has legalized gay marriage. And by that, we don't mean happy marriage. We mean homosexual marriage. That's right. Vermont on Tuesday became the 4th state to legalize gay marriage and the first to do so with the vote of their legislature. Now, folks, think about that. A legislature in the United States of America has affirmed homosexual marriage. Now, 40 years ago, had you pondered the idea that a legislature in any state in the United States would legalize homosexual marriage. Let's go back to 1969. You'd have been laughed at. It would have been thought ridiculous. For advocates within the homosexual community, they would have been called extremists. You can't expect a legislature to legalize homosexual marriage. You're just being extreme. Calm down. We'll just come out of the closet slowly. Don't try to go for everything all at once. So, this is just a word to folks in the pro-life movement who have accused we in the personhood wing of the pro-life movement of being extremists, of being absolutists, and for criticizing us for going for too much, because we are laying the foundations of the personhood movement. 40 years from now, when we win, and I hope it's sooner, but I'm realistic. I'm not. I don't have my head in the clouds. Unless something extremely dramatic happened upon the political scene, I can see no way that personhood can be affirmed in the United States before I retire. Let's just put it that way. At least that's my gut feeling on the issue. But don't let that keep us from laying the foundations of a movement that eventually will carry the day. Okay? If the homosexuals and the freaks and the weirdos and the deviants and the perverts are willing to work for 40 years, we've got to match them. And we're on solid ground. We've got the truth on our side. All they had was public opinion. We must stand for the truth, even though we may not win at the ballot box this year, we may not win next year. But don't call me an absolutist, don't call me an extremist, because I want every American voter to have the opportunity to cast their vote on the personhood of an unborn child. Because I truly believe that if we force that vote, every time a voter is forced to take a stand on that issue, we win. We win in the hearts and minds of the people. Some people have avoided the issue their whole lives, and when forced to consider it, will also consider the idea that there is absolute truth. And a portion of those people will consider the idea of truth, and they will consider the idea of God, and they will come to the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and their living souls shall be saved from hell. And that is a victory. So not only can we win the political victory, if we build our house on the rock, if we build our movement on the rock, the truth of personhood, and we persevere, not only can we win politically, but we can win spiritually every day just by proclaiming the message. Now back to the queers in Vermont. House Speaker Shap Smith's announcement of the vote brought an outburst of jubilation from some of the hundreds packed into the gallery in the lobby outside the House chamber, despite the Speaker's admonishment against such displays. And I would just say to you, Speaker Smith, how can you admonish anyone against any kind of display when you've just legalized homosexual marriage? There are pretty much no displays against which people can be admonished from here on out. Okay, Speaker? Craig Benson, a gay marriage opponent who had lobbied unsuccessfully for a non-binding referendum on the question, said he was disappointed but believed gay marriage opponents were outspent by supporters by a 20-to-1 margin. Another message to the personhood movement. You see how the queers and the freaks and the deviants have defeated us? They've gotten their money together early and they've persevered. We have to put our money where our mind is, where our heart is, and we have to start doing it now. We have to stop giving our money to people who would regulate the killing of innocent people and start funding those who are standing for the absolute truth that an innocent unborn child is a human being, is a person, and we have to get our money together early. You know, they say that no life is ever wasted and that one can always at least serve as a bad example. And that's the case in that is exactly the case in the homosexual rights movement. They can serve as a bad example, and we can take the things that they did that were politically successful, like early money, perseverance, and never questioning their ideals, and we can apply them to our movement, because and we have the truth on our side. We're not a bunch of deviant perverts trying to corrupt and destroy the culture. We're trying to save innocent people, for crying out loud. Let's see. Was there any more from the queers in Vermont? Oh, also in the crowd was Michael Finer, a farmer from Roxbury and a gay marriage supporter who took a break from collecting sap for maple syrup making to come to the State House. Now, that's just disturbing. I mean, when I think of a big strapping Vermont farmer out gathering the maple sap to make the syrup, I just don't picture him taking a day off to go down to the State House and celebrate homosexual marriage. He said, quote, I'm taking a break to come and basically make sure that I was here to witness history. Oh, yeah, right. He's from Vermont. He was probably cruising. I'm Doug McBurney, and this is the Weekly Worldview special midweek edition coming at you from the underground subterranean studios of the weeklyworldview.com. So glad to have you aboard. And we continue now into the Death of Western Civilization file. I reported a few weeks ago on a story about the birth rate in the United States and how that basically it is stagnant. It's been stagnant for the last 50 years. Although it was reported as if we had set some kind of record. And if you don't recall that, you got to go back two or three shows in the files there and check it out. But here's a CNN article that's about a young couple named Kim Hoffman and Steve Miller. Well, they recently got married. Yes. And now the CNN reporter spoke with the father of Kim Hoffman. And, well, it appears that on the day they got married, Kim and Steve had a 10-month-old baby. Yeah, that attended the wedding. And the father of the bride said, well, you know, pre-marriage birth certainly wasn't what I wanted for my only daughter. Certainly wasn't what he wanted. But, you know, 7 months into her relationship with young Steve Miller, an unplanned pregnancy simply changed life's course. And now, according to the bride, she says, quote, we would have headed down this path. The pregnancy just accelerated things, she said, of the couple's cohabitation, the birth of Sadie, and their 2005 wedding. It was the way it was meant to be. That's what she said. It was the way it was meant to be. Now, truly, this gives you an insight into the mindset of the generation that will lose Western civilization, because she thinks that it was the way it was meant to be. But that's not the way it was meant to be. What was meant to be was that you date, you fall in love, you get married, then you have a kid. That's how it was meant to be. The way you did it would be called screwing it all up. Yeah, it would be called a mistake. You did it wrong. You did it improperly. You did it wrongly. That wrongly, I think, would be the appropriate adjective there. You did it improperly. But she thinks that it was the way it was meant to be. Now, I'm thankful that at least this couple didn't choose to kill their unborn child. That's somewhat encouraging. But the fact that they think that this is the way it was meant to be, I doubt they're Calvinists. I doubt they're Christians. I doubt they believe in predestination. I doubt they even know what it means. They just think that this is fine. You know, we got together, we shacked up for a while, we had a kid. So, hey, we're getting married. Well, I mean, God bless you, it's the honorable thing to do to marry the slut and not kill the child. I mean, that's good for young Steve. But let's not confuse that with the way it was meant to be, okay? Let's teach our children that the way it was meant to be is that you meet someone, you date, you fall in love, get married, then you have kids. That's the way it was meant to be. By the way, the article closes with an interesting fact. Nearly 40% of babies born in the United States in 2007 were delivered by unwed mothers. And that's across the board. All ethnicities, all races, all religions, all five genders, all mothers. Well, actually, there was only one gender. That would have been females, because they're the only ones who actually give birth, I think. I think that's true still. Let's hope so. Anyway, 40% of babies born in the United States in 07 were delivered by unwed mothers, according to data released last month by the National Center for Health Statistics, making that a 25% increase in single-parent births, a 25% increase in bastard children from when? How long do you think that goes back, the 25% increase? Does that go back to 1975, 1985, 1987, 1997? You think 10 years it took us to do a 25% increase? No. The 25% increase occurred between 2002 and 2007. So in 5 years, there's been a 25% increase in the number of unwed mothers. And that is not the way it was meant to be. And that's not my opinion. That's the truth. Okay? Now here's a little different twist on the whole marriage thing. Okay? And I don't know where I'm going to go with this, but I decided to read it. And so I'm just going to go with it and see if it takes me somewhere that's beneficial and edifying in any way. And if I see that's not going to happen, I may abandon the story in mid-sentence and just move on. Dateline Salinas, California. A California man accused of selling his 14-year-old daughter into marriage for $16,000, beer, and meat has pleaded no contest to felony child endangerment. Marcelino de Jesus Martinez made a deal with the family of Margarito de Jesus Galindo. They negotiated the marriage contract for $16,000 cash, an undisclosed quantity of beer and meat, and they negotiated a marriage dowry contract. And apparently, this was only discovered when Martinez went to police to get his daughter back because payment was not made. So we don't know if it was the cash that didn't come through, maybe some portion of the beer was withheld, or perhaps the meat was, I don't know, it wasn't a choice cut. I don't know what they had negotiated, but the deal was discovered when this guy actually went to the police to get his daughter back. And anyway, I think that if you want to arrange a marriage, I'm not necessarily averse to that, but we certainly need to observe the statutory laws in whatever state we're living in. 14 is a little young, and I think that a wise parent would simply be more subtle about it. And instead of outright contracting for some quantity of beer and meat, maybe just encourage two young people to get together and build each other up so that they like each other, and then encourage them to get married of their own volition. So you're arranging it in some way, but you're not outright negotiating for cash and beer, you know, for your kid. Okay, that's all. And so I don't know that that was edifying or in any way, and maybe it should have been abandoned, but it made the cut. Do I want to do an update on this story about the... Well, I really don't think I want to. No, I don't want to. Okay, but let's do an update on murderer O.J. Simpson, Dateline Santa Monica, California. A man who says he spent years helping O.J. Simpson hide his assets from the families of slaying victims Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson was ordered Monday to appear in court to respond to a lawsuit demanding he hand over any Simpson memorabilia he has. The lawsuit was filed after... What's this guy's name? Michael Gilbert published a book called... Now, this is the title of the book, ladies and gentlemen. How I Helped O.J. Get Away with Murder. The Shocking Inside Story of Violence, Loyalty, Regret, and Remorse. Now, just the fact that someone could publish a book with a title, How I Helped So-and-So Get Away with Murder... That in and of itself tells me that there's a problem with the justice system. And I think the first problem with the justice system in this particular case was that they helped O.J. get away with murder. The judge, the court system, the lawyers, all of the lawyers involved on both sides, they all aided and abetted O.J. Simpson after the fact. This guy Gilbert, Michael Gilbert, he was apparently once O.J. Simpson's agent, and holds some quantity of O.J. Simpson memorabilia, which is apparently very valuable because there's this macabre interest in collecting O.J. Simpson memorabilia since he's one of the few people on the planet to cut off someone's head and walk away free for a time. And so people are, for some reason, fascinated with that. And I think it's on a very prurient level because I'm fascinated with it, don't get me wrong. I'm fascinated in the way that it points out the corruption and the utter failure and collapse of the justice system in the United States. But I wouldn't be shelling out any cash for his memorabilia on eBay. I mean, unless I plan to burn it or destroy it in some way in a public place and make a very needed and poignant commentary on the state of the justice system and the basic collapse of domestic tranquility here in the United States. But that's just an update on OJ. He is still in jail, by the way. How long is his sentence? I believe it was here in the story. He's serving one of these very creative liberal sentences. I forget, it's like 10 to 31 years. Oh, yeah, oh, here it is. Simpson is currently serving a sentence of 9 to 33 years in prison. I guess that depends on... I mean, I don't know what that depends on. If he's a good boy and he doesn't cut anyone's head off, he'll get out in 9 years. If he goes on a rampage in there in prison or doesn't obey the rules or whatever, or doesn't perform well on the basketball court, then he'll do 33 years. Anyways, you know what that's all about. Okay, Newt Gingrich this week told CNN that the Obama administration, is intensely secular and anti-religious. He said, quote, "I think their goal," there at the Obama administration, "is to have a very secular America in which government dominates everything." And that's different from what Newt Gingrich and the Republicans want. They want not a very secular government, but just a secular government. And they don't want the government to dominate everything, just almost everything. So, as I say, the Republicans, the Democrats are taking us over the cliff in a Ferrari, and the Republicans are taking us over the cliff with a horse and buggy, but they're both going over the cliff. Now, here's an interview with Barack. No, no, it's not Barack. I'm sorry. It's Joel Osteen and Larry King. If you didn't get to see this, roll the tape. Larry King says, "Joel, since you were last on, we have sworn in our first American president. What are your impressions of Barack Obama?" To which Osteen replied, "Well, I think he's doing a great job. I'm impressed with his skill, his calmness, his strength under pressure. These are tough times for him." "And you, Victoria, what are your impressions?"
"Joel, I've been really impressed. In fact, I've been impressed with the First Lady. She stepped up, and she's done a remarkable job."
"Well, recent polls show 12% of Americans still believe Obama's a Muslim, and 35% say they don't know his religion, but that most of them say it doesn't matter. Should it matter?"
"Well, Larry, it matters to me. It matters to me that I know he loves the Lord, and I think it's important that he has convictions from his faith. So to me, it matters when I'm making my personal decision."
"Does it matter to you, Victoria?"
"It does. It does matter to me. I believe he's a Christian."
"Well, the Hope for Today Bible. Let's get to that. The Hope for Today Bible. This is a new Bible produced by you. How is this different from other Bibles?"
"Well, Larry, it's a living translation of the Bible, which is an easy version to read. And then it's got our notes beside certain passages, and it just helps people maybe understand the Bible a bit easier."
"Do you think that eventually many more states are going to allow same-sex marriage, Joel?"
"You know, Larry, I don't know where it's all going. I'd love to see it stay between a male and a female, but I'm not knocking anybody else, Larry."
So that was, I pulled that out of the Death of Evangelicalism file. To close the show, ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Weekly Worldview, coming to you from the subterranean studios here at theweeklyworldview.com. I want to thank my friends at kgov.com. I want to thank my friends at Denver Bible Church and over at personhoodusa.com and American Right to Life. I want to thank you all for joining us, and I want to thank my other brother, Daryl, for helping us make it all happen right here in the weeklyworldview.com studios. Until next week, may the peace of God be with you, and may his grace be upon you, and God bless you all.